We continue our series this week on deadly Hurricane Maria. It's the one-year anniversary of when Maria slammed ashore Puerto Rico on September 20th, 2017. Some 3,000 people died, but most of those deaths were not from the wind and rain, but the isolation that followed the storm. The slow aid response after the hurricane left vulnerable people stranded for weeks and months. Many died from treatable infections, contaminated water, or electrocution from downed power lines. 9 months after Maria, I traveled to Puerto Rico and found people that are now looking to each other, not the government, to create more resilient communities and prepare for the next storm.
Half a mile, keep left onto Camino, Antonio Rodriguez.
To get to Humacao, Puerto Rico, you can take Highway 53, past McDonald's, grocery stores, and car dealerships. Except for the palm trees, it feels like you could be anywhere in the U.S. But turn up the narrow, twisty mountain road towards Humacao, and it's a different story. Electrical poles stick out of the ground at awkward angles. Electrical wires hang casually over the road, swaying in a light breeze.
There's a lot of posts that look like they're about to fall on people, trees that look near highways that look like they're about to fall on cars. And that actually happened.
Cristina Nieves is director of the Proyecto Apoyo Mutuo, the mutual aid project, based in a community center at the very top of the mountain in Humacao. Cristina says downed power lines and unstable trees are now common here.
There was a tragedy not too long ago of a young man dying from having a tree collapse on top of him. So you're still seeing that.
Cristina is petite with wavy black hair and a bright smile. She wears a flowy pink top and long earrings. She left Puerto Rico to go to college at Penn State and then got her master's degree at Oxford in England. She came back to Puerto Rico 6 months before Maria hit the island and settled here in Humacao, where the hurricane actually made landfall. Cristina leads the way across a large parking lot to the edge of the mountain and points to a wide green valley below us.
So this is where the eye of the hurricane enters. So
through this valley.
Yes, it actually made landfall first in this community and all of these mountains.
But just to describe this area where we are, so right there is the ocean. So that's obviously where the hurricane came in and just traveled up this little valley in between us here, between us, the mountain that we're standing on, and that mountain over there, and hit these homes right in front of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Were you here during the hurricane?
I was. Yeah, my house is actually not too far from here.
Wow. So what did it feel like?
It was chaotic. We prepared so well because we had basically a two-week heads up. We were prepared from Irma already. We had storm shutters were up. We got water, you know, a few days before the hurricane, and we filled our cistern. But the actual hurricane, because we were so close, we started feeling it on the 19th. One in the morning, we wake up, we start feeling and hearing the sounds, and it's just loud and you can barely hear each other. And that's when we started noticing that the water was coming in
through into your house.
Yeah, through all the windows, through the storm shutters. It didn't matter, it was just coming through. And at first we were actually trying to figure out if we could dry the water and like address that. And then we also started noticing that we have all of our doors, our glass sliding doors, and we noticed that the glass was bending inward. So to try to keep it from being pushed into the house, we took all of our furniture and put it, you know, backed it up from the door to the wall, like in a chain. And it was like the table and the chair and the bookshelf and everything supported each other for all the way to the nearest column. But that didn't help. And it was around 4 in the morning that the skylights exploded in, and then the window exploded in as well. So there was glass flying. So at that point, we actually got into the safest spot, which was a bathroom under the staircase that had not a lot, you know, other than the door. There was no way of getting in or out. And we got in. Dog, cat, 3 adults in this tiny bathroom, and just waited. And then we started seeing the water coming in from under the door. And it's just like coming in. And we were just like, what do we do? So we just put everything we had, and basically everything that got wet, we had to toss away. And it was just the hurricane came in. So it was not just water, it was leaves. And then the painting from inside the walls was scraped off from the pressure. It was like a pressure washer had come into the house and just scraped not only outside, but inside.
The paint came right off your walls.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds really scary.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was... Luis is a musician, so he was playing, my partner, he was playing the guitar. His cousin is also, you know, his entire family plays some sort of instrument. So he was playing the drums and, or the, you know, percussion. And so we were dealing with it by singing. And we spent the entire hurricane like that. And then once we actually got into the bathroom, there was not a lot of space. So we kind of took a nap sometime in the middle of the night because you're so exhausted and there's nothing you can do. You know, everything's getting destroyed. And when we came out at 7 in the morning, we noticed that our 2,000-gallon cistern had, something had come off. So the entire cistern was emptying out. And that was just at the moment when the wind started changing directions. We never felt the calm of the storm. We were kind of, it was basically the wall of the eye. We never got the actual eye. So this was like the wall of the eye just passed right through. So we got because of our altitude, we also got the strongest winds. And some of the storm shutters were actually pulled off from the wall. It was something so massive that you can't quite understand it and comprehend it when you see that something that's designed to withstand storms didn't. That's when you realize, okay, we're dealing with something that's beyond the scales that we're used to.
Yeah. And so this forest right in front of us, I mean, you can see that it used to be a forest, and it still is to some degree, but there's no leaves really on the side of the trees, and that all of the tops are cut off at the same length, at the same height.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all of these trees that you see here, they were massive. You couldn't see beyond them. It was so thick. You couldn't see the houses even. It looks much better 8 months later because nature is so wonderful and it can bounce back so much faster than human beings can in many ways. Mm. But that was actually one of the first things I noticed, that even before FEMA had arrived to Mariana, we were seeing the trees bouncing back. So the trees were faster in their response than FEMA even.
Yeah, it looks like a big chainsaw went through and just cut the tops off everything and stripped the sides off the trees.
Yeah. No, it was like a bomb exploded. And it was also, if you had come here the days after, it looked just like sticks, like matched sticks, just like sticking up. Everything looked gray. And it was actually one of the hardest things, because if people that live here obviously love nature. And it's one of the reasons why I moved back. And it was very hard to see the amount of destruction.
When you came out here, you know, the day or two after the hurricane, and you looked out here, how did it make you feel to see it look so different, to see the trees just denuded?
Well, when we walked out of the bathroom and went to one of the windows in the house, we were on the bottom part of the house. Oh my God. Luis, actually, my partner, started crying because those were the trees that he grew up with. And it was just a complete feeling of, it was like all the movies that you've seen of Armageddon, of destruction, of the end of days. It was like, this is done. And the fact that the communication collapsed meant that also we couldn't hear the government, but we couldn't hear each other. All we had was the people next to us.
In my 2.5 weeks reporting in Puerto Rico, I heard this same sentiment over and over again. Communities were isolated. FEMA and the government were slow to respond, so people turned to their neighbors for help. In many cases, the dense forest before the hurricane had blocked their view of each other. People might not know there was a house across the street or down the way a bit. But after Maria turned the lush forest into matchsticks, neighbors could see each other for the first time and came to rely on one another for help.
The people in this area understand that the government is not going to respond and save them. It's actually going to be their neighbors having, you know, the machetes ready, knowing how to disinfect a wound. That's one of the things that they saw the most, was wounds that could have been disinfected ended up in amputations. So they had to cut so many feet off because people wearing flip-flops in standing water that had infections, and they just couldn't, they didn't have something like iodine or something that could be easily over-the-counter anyone can have, disinfecting the wound at the right time. So it's that kind of education and preparedness and also community organizing to prepare for the next hurricane.
Most of the residents of Umakau are older, retirees who live alone and have been without electricity since the hurricane. Christina takes me to meet one of them.
Let's go find Gloria.
Okay.
So I'll just follow you guys in my
car.
I follow Christina down the mountain to meet Gloria Vasquez at her house a few miles away. A downed electrical wire grazes the top of a car parked in front of her house. She's standing on her porch watering a potted pepper plant.
Hello, buenas.
¿Cómo estás?
Bien, bien. Gloria.
Gloria, mucho gusto. Bobby.
Okay. Entonces tengo allí. Let me show her something that I'm planting.
Oh, of course. You can see it.
Gloria is 70 years old. She wears an oversized red t-shirt and her hair slicked back in a small ponytail. Her house sits on the side of the mountain overlooking the valley. She can see clear to the ocean some 40 miles away. Before the hurricane, Gloria says she could only see the dense forest in her yard and an avocado tree taller than her house.
Tree, it was so big, tall, it filled me very, very bad. And I cried like crazy because I don't think the Puerto Rico is going to be like that. You know.
You didn't think it could look like that?
No. No, I don't think it's going to be like that. And it's still, I feel, about what happened to Puerto Rico.
Gloria has accepted her lost trees and the broken landscape, but she's still struggling to deal with the day-to-day life, living alone without electricity.
It's hard. Sometimes I sit there and I cry because I need the light, you know? I don't have no fridge to cool my stuff because I got diabetes and I need to put the insulin in the fridge.
So what do you do?
No, what I do? Sometimes I take it to the ladies, my neighbor, Sandra, and then Sandra give me a key to put them inside the refrigerator. Then she got a generator.
So what do you do? How do you manage it at nighttime?
Okay. By 6:30, I started getting darker. So I locked the gate and I locked the door and I stay inside the house because you don't know. You know, it's a lot of thief here.
A lot of theft?
Yeah. They ask me, are you there by yourself? No, I'm not by myself. I got a husband. My husband is a police and he's working.
Gloria lived most of her life in the Bronx. She moved there as a teenager with her family and worked for 50 years, mostly as a hairdresser. She saved her money all those years to retire in her native Puerto Rico, where she bought this 3-bedroom cement house.
Yes, you want to come inside the house?
Yeah.
This is the living room over here, in my dining room and the kitchen. You see, it's dark. Let me get the flashlight.
Gloria shows me around her dark house. She pauses at a creche and a statue of the Virgin Mary given to her by her mother.
Yeah, she gave me this one and this one here. And they're always here with me. Those are the ones that take care of me.
She points out framed pictures of her grandchildren and her 3 sons.
That's my baby boy here when he graduated.
How old is he now?
He's going to be 40. Oh. And that's me when I graduated from beauty school, Midway Beauty School in New York.
In her tidy kitchen, Gloria has a few vegetables on the counter, a gas stove, a refrigerator empty but for a bottle of maple syrup, and a small red cooler on the floor where she keeps perishables like milk.
But I don't buy no meat because meat is getting worse quick.
It goes bad quickly.
Yeah.
So what do you eat then?
If I want to eat something, I go into the store right there, buy whatever I want to eat, and then I bring it. Today, I'm going to eat verdura.
Vegetables.
Yeah. This is my dinner for today.
You have an eggplant and plantain.
Eggplant, banana, and potato. That's my dinner and my lunch. It's going to be today, and this, jamonilla.
That's like spam.
Yeah, spam. And then I cook it, and I eat half, and I left the other half for later. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's the life here. Hard, but you know, what I'm gonna do.
That's the life for most of the residents in Umacao. The majority of people here are elderly, living alone and without power. That isolation can be depressing and deadly. But since Maria hit, locals are looking to each other for solace and sustenance. The next day, I drove the twisty road back to the Mountaintop Community Center in Umacao. Half a dozen older women have gathered today to cook for their neighbors, as they do each week, Monday through Friday. There's a sign out front that indicates when they'll be cooking and says, "Aceptamos donativos solidarios." We accept solidarity donations. For $5, anyone can buy a homemade lunch of rice, beans, and meat. Maybe some fruit if one of the ladies has extra papaya or pineapple coming up at home. Today, a woman, ironically named Maria, is cooking up chunks of pork.
This is pork. I like to make it soft and nice and tender. Very bite.
Very good.
It is. It is. And you can make it with this and rice and beans. Oh, gosh, we're eating good here.
Maria says coming here to feed the community is a type of therapy for her. She gets out of her lonely, dark house for the day and cooks with her friends. They chat about family and argue like sisters. Life feels normal again. This theme of working together and resilience is everywhere in post-Maria Puerto Rico. About 9 months after the storm, a local musician named Hooray for the Riff Raff produced a song in part about recovery on the island. The music video shows scenes of a hurricane-ravaged community and tells the story of a young family trying to work through it.
From El Barrio to Arecibo, Palante. From Marble Hill to the coast of Emmett Till, Palante.
Palante is truncated from the Spanish phrase para adelante, which literally means move forward. But Umacao community organizer Cristina Nieves says it means much more than that now.
So palante means, it means that we're going to keep moving forward. We're going to keep rising and we're going to keep fighting. And I think it also means for me and what we're doing is about connecting with the root. We'll look back at this moment in history and I think it'll have a huge fork on the road where in what it does to the Puerto Rican psyche. The conclusion at the end of this disaster that we're still living it is that it was us. We were the ones that could respond. We were the ones that had to and that were capable of saving lives. And it was community members that were able to that were capable of doing it. So pa'lante, we keep building.
To my mother and my
if there's any silver lining to the devastation that Maria brought here, it might be this. A renewed sense of community, Puerto Rican pride, and resiliency that people hope will keep them moving forward to rebuild and meet the next challenge together.